But inflation stuck at 2.9%, and it's not going back to 2% anytime soon. The rate cuts last year were a mistake. Now, you look at core PCE, last 3 months, Q1, it's expected to run at 4.3% annualized pace. That's hot. If they're holding steady right now, while inflation's going up, what's happening? The policy is basically getting looser.
Sonu Varghese is VP and global macro strategist at Carson Group.
With 20 years of experience turning global macro chaos into portfolio decisions that actually make money.
That's a positive, especially over the short term for equities. It's very positive for gold. So at some point, Fed chair may come in saying, you know, we need to get this back under control. We're going to raise rates. Yes, that may mean a recession. So that's it. Like a lot of analogies compare this current period because of AI and technology to the 90s. And like maybe the more apt comparison is to the late 60s.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal, and welcome to Sonu. It's nice to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Pascal. It's an honor to be here. I love the name of the podcast as well, Less Noise, More Signal. I feel like that's what we all try to do in financial markets. But real quick intro, I am Chief Macro Strategist here at Carson Group. Carson Group is a $57 billion RIA. As I look on my screen, markets are going up. That's good for us. So it's about a $57 billion RIA. We have over 500 advisors, investment advisors across the country, several offices. I am based in Chicago myself. My role is I lead our asset allocation team. I work closely with a few of the folks here. We manage portfolios as well and give advice explicitly. Like a lot of our model, we manage about $7 to $8 billion directly invested in the models. These are both strategic models and tactical models. Some of them are, a lot of them tend to be risk constrained, like your moderate portfolio, moderate tactical portfolio, moderate strategic portfolio. Strategic portfolio is based on long-term views. Tactical, we tend to, you're not trading, day trading, anything like that. It's still about, let's say about 6 months outlook, depending on moves. Doesn't mean we won't trade in between, we will, if we change our views. But generally, somewhere between 4 to 8 months or so is that's what a tactical view is. We have some unconstrained portfolios as well, which I've managed for over 13 years now. That's, you know, that all of my money is invested in that. And that's 0 to 100. It can go 0% equities, 100% equities, you know, anywhere in between. We can talk about how we are positioned. But that, in a nutshell, is what I do. I mean, what I'm trying to do is trying to figure out what's happening in the world around us, you know, macroeconomic data, the global economy, capital flows, central bank policy, fiscal policy, and then try to create our own views based on that and then convert that into portfolio decisions.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, thanks for taking it up right away and introducing yourself. I mean, you said something interesting there that I want to double click on, you know, like, the tactical views that you have for a couple of months, you know, and you don't do the day trading. I guess from what I can tell, you've been in this space a little longer than me in finance, you know, and how have things changed, especially nowadays? What I hear from other PMs and just people out of the financial industry, you know, they're like, you know, things have changed just dramatically in the last couple of months, given that, you know, Trump is tweeting all the time and there's that much volatility. And then even though you might not be like a tactical day or swing trader, it almost feels like you kind of have to, or do you guys just try to avoid all of this and zoom out and say, okay, you know, we're not caring about this? Or how do you deal with this sort of volatility and the way you manage money? That would be interesting to know up front.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I feel like it started to change, like information is coming really fast. Now, I've been in the industry for about 20 years, so I've been in the industry during the internet era. when information has been coming fast, even during the GFC, the Great Financial Crisis, 2007, 2008, there was so much headline news. I mean, you know, thinking back to September and October of 2008, like, you know, there was Lehman fell, and then AIG was literally the next day. And then 2, 3, 4 weeks later, you know, there's a big question of, will Congress approve TARP, right? I think the moment they said no, I think the vote failed with the Congress. And the Dow fell, I think, 600 points or something. 600 points back then made a big difference. Now it's not as big of a, you know, change. 600 points is like 1% or something like that. That point, yeah. 600 points is like a much bigger move. And then the next day, you know, I think there were news reports that Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, literally, I mean, this is a joke probably, but knelt down in front of Nancy Pelosi, asking, begging him to pass TARP. And then it went through, markets rallied, came back down. So all this to say, we've had these headline sort of movements for a while now. Now it seems more, for sure. Even during COVID, I mean, of course, Trump was president then too, right? We had like, will there be a shutdown? Then things were shut down. And then we got the CARES Act, this massive stimulus package. And then we got the headlines from the Fed. The Fed's buying not just, you know, treasuries or an MBS, mortgage-backed securities. They're buying corporate bonds as well. They're buying high-yield bonds as well. They're buying ETFs. So all of this is in the... So I think in some sense, things have changed. And that's what's changed is mostly the rate at which information comes at you and the rate at which markets react. But at the end of the day, pulling back, some things haven't changed. Over a slightly longer period of time, what do markets care about? Profits. I mean, in the interim, yes, we can go up and down, up and down. And I think even this crisis, right, over the last month, I think it's puzzled a lot of people. Wait a minute. The Strait of Hormuz is closed. That's a big deal. Mm. Right? I grew up in the Middle East, actually, in Oman. So this is very salient. In fact, I took my family to visit back in November. So we went snorkeling around the Gulf of Oman, too. And so if you'd asked me before the crisis, I was like, yeah, that's a big deal. But then stock markets have recovered. I mean, even before today's news about, like, we're recording this on April 17th, there's news that Iran's saying the strait is open. I'm sure there's an asterisk there saying they have to take the route Iran wants you to take. So all that aside, markets are rallying over 1%. We've got new highs for the S&P 500 and even the NASDAQ. But, you know, the bigger picture is profit expectations are continuously going up over the last 6 weeks. At the end of the day, now we can talk about why, separate thing, but that's been going up. And at the end of the day, bigger picture, that's what matters.
Yes, certainly I want to zoom into some of these topics that you just mentioned. And I feel like, you're hitting on the nail there. You know, we've seen this confluence just in the last couple of days. And now I feel like today is this point of no return, let's hope, where I feel like, okay, markets are no longer moving on war headlines, you know, because we've seen that in the last couple of days.
Or maybe like, today's the last day it moves on war headlines. I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, we'll see. But and I feel like, but as you said, you know, the strait has been closed for a couple of weeks now, or even potentially months, you know. And I think you had Roy on your
Rory
show.
Rory Johnston
on your show. And he also just recently put out a tweet where he was calculating how much oil has not been produced because of what's going on. And so we're running behind. And I guess this will have second order, third order consequences, no doubt.
Yes.
You know, but now everyone is keen on assessing how much will these be, you know, what would actually be, will it actually be as worse as bad as some are expecting? So maybe we can start there, you know, and maybe it's even start with the inflation. How do you think about this? How will it feed into inflation, and what's the current state? If you zoom in, give us the full picture on what's really going on with inflation.
Yeah. So connecting all of that, I say, it was fantastic. I have Rory Johnston, who's been a big follower of his for years now, since the Russia-Ukraine crisis, and he's a great writer of energy markets and what's happening within energy markets. Yeah, and so I should say we had him on our podcast, Facts vs. Feelings, which is a lot of fun. And I do that with my colleague, Ryan Dietrich, who's chief market strategist here at Carson. And we manage several of the portfolios that I mentioned together. But yeah, no, like when you look at equity markets, I'll start there. It feels like oh, the equity markets have shrunk the whole thing up. There's no cost. But it's a little tricky. But then you look at the, so you think, okay, where's the cost of this? We're missing, let's say, about 900 million barrels of oil. Hasn't been produced. It's shut in, right? Even if today they say, let's say the crisis is over by Monday, everything's, barrels that were shut in start to get produced again. You're still, based on Rory's numbers, short about 900 million barrels of oil. Now, we had a surplus coming into the year, and then strategic petroleum reserves have been released, things like that. I think the cost is in the bond market. Look at the yields, the 10-year yield. Before the crisis, it was 395, 396. Today, even after the drop, it's about 425. Now, 25, 30 basis points, and look at 2-year yields. Right? 2-year yields is an estimate of what Fed policy rates will be over the next 2 years on average, right? Before the crisis, we were something about 340, something like that. Today, even after the good news about the Strait reopening, we are close to about 370, 375, 370, thereabouts. The Fed funds rate is at 360, which means the market's completely taken out expectations of rate cuts, right? Before the crisis, we were, you know, I think markets are expecting 2 to 3 rate cuts by the end of 2026 here in the U.S. That's gone now. So when you have, when somebody asks, oh, there was no cost, look at equities. It's like, no, there's been a cost. That cost shows up in the bond market. Why is it showing up in the bond market? That gets to inflation, right? Going to your question about inflation. So when we came into the year, just rewinding a little bit, we were in the camp that we'd see a period of inflationary growth, which is fairly good for equities, if you think about it. And we can get into why, right? And because usually there were other people I respect who thought, you know, no, inflation's coming down, but economic growth is also slowing. They were worried more about a recession and because of the labor market. And I always thought, I think the labor market is stronger than the headline payroll numbers suggest, right? And I think that's kind of borne out. The unemployment rate has gone down to about 4.26%. We've averaged, I know it's very noisy, but payrolls have averaged about 68,000 per month over the last 3 months, right? If you think break even because of low immigration or immigration collapse, if break even, how many jobs does the economy need to create to keep the unemployment, you know, in line and to keep up with population growth? Maybe that's zero now. Then 68,000 doesn't look too bad. 68,000 looks very good, right? And that, but then, we were also in the camp that the Fed had an inflation problem before the crisis. Now, over the last month, everyone's going to be talking about gasoline prices. Gasoline prices have increased from $2.80 a gallon here in the U.S. to, you know, over $4 a gallon. That's going to come back down, you know, slowly. It's going to come down slower than it went up because oil prices are going down. Just the way it works, right?
Yeah, prices go up like a rocket.
Yeah, like a rocket.
Yeah, like a rocket,
and they come down like feathers.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, precisely. So, but then, and we can share this chart. If you look at the core inflation, and this is the Fed's preferred metric, which is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, right? And I think CPI gets more headlines. CPI is released before PCE during the month. The PCE comes out with like a 2-week lag. CPI gets all the headlines, but CPI is about 33% shelter. And if you take core CPI, core inflation, core CPI, it's about 42%. Then you add in used cars. That's another 4%. So almost half the basket, 46% is shelter and used cars. Both of them are seeing, you know, used cars are seeing deflation, shelter is seeing disinflation. But even with that positive tailwind for shelter and used cars, core CPI is still running at 2.9%. That's hard. I mean, you think like we have a huge tailwind and, you know, shelter is completely normalized. In fact, it's running below pre-pandemic pace of inflation. Used car prices are going down over the last 3-4 months, but inflation stuck at 2.9%. And that gets to core PCE. Why did the Fed move to PCE, by the way, instead of CPI? PCE is more broad. And I'll bring up why, you know, I think that's important too and it's useful. And PCE can be revised. CPI is not revised. And also, PCE accounts for substitution of, like, if my burger goes, you know, from $20 to $25, I don't want to pay $25 anymore. Maybe I'll pick the cheaper chicken sandwich instead of buying a burger. So it accounts for that substitution effect. for goods and services. So the Fed switched from CPI to PCE back in 2000. Now, you look at core PCE, we can share this chart, and I'll send this to you. PCE for excluding food and energy. Over the last year, it's been picking up. It's running at 3.2% year over year. And by the way, this was, you know, estimate using some March estimates as well. So it picks up. And this is excluding gasoline, right? Last 3 months, Q1, it's expected to run at 4.3% annualized pace. That's hot, right? And that gets to the fact that I think even before all this, inflation is not just going to be a gasoline problem. It's a much broader problem.
Yes, yes. Exactly. And I want to also zero in on this. I mean, if you're now telling me shelter is sort of disinflating the car sales, you know, auto car sales is like even deflationary. But now we have oil, you know, gasoline, which is kind of maybe somewhat elevated. Like what else is then driving this higher inflation, you know? And I think you can even talk to the breadth of inflation, right? That has been increasing over the years, which is also an interesting finding. And what does this tell you, you know, if you're not only looking at the inflation rate as a sort of lump sum number, or but you're looking at each component?
Yeah, exactly. So the immediate thing that everyone sort of will blame, a culprit, you know, why is inflation hot? Despite, you know, set aside the gasoline price. Why is core inflation running hot? Core PC. Everybody will say, oh, it's tariffs. And yes, that's had an impact. Durable goods inflation is running at 2.8%. 2.8% doesn't sound like a lot, except if we didn't have tariffs, prices would be going down. We'd be seeing deflation. That's what we saw from 1996 till 2021. Then because of the pandemic, we saw prices go up. But 2023, 2024, it was back down again. Now it's running at 2.8%. The counterfactual is, durable goods prices would probably be about 6 to 8% lower, if not for the tariffs. But I don't think it's just the tariffs. The tariffs, actually, the peak effective tariff rate was about 11, 12% several months ago, maybe in October, November. Since then, it's been coming down. But we've been seeing a pickup in durable goods inflation in January, February, and March. One thing that's happened is we are seeing the price of anything related to the AI build-out, computer software, printed circuit boards, you look at PPI, things like that. You know, PCE for computer software, which is counted as a good, that's running at 12% year over year. Up until last year, prices were going down. So I don't think it's just tariffs. I think there's the AI-related bottlenecks as well. And then you look at services. Service also running hard. So what I did is I looked at 178 categories in core PCE. And this is where PCE is, again, more useful than CPI because it's much broader. And things are, from a distribution perspective, things are looking much worse than a year ago. Back in December 2019, 24, and we can share this chart. I'll send you this chart. December 2019, 24% of those 178 items, 24% had 3% plus inflation. Let's say that's normal. June 2022, inflation spikes, highest inflation rate in 40 plus years. 72% had inflation rates over 3%. Things started improving. By February of 2025, almost a year ago, 45% of items had 3% plus inflation rates. Now that's gone back up to about 54%. Right? 54% of items now have 3% plus year over year inflation rates. Before the pandemic, we were at 24%. Wow. Even if you look at the number of percentage of items with 4% plus inflation, before the pandemic, we were at 10%. Now we are at almost 40%.
So interesting. I mean, to your point, you know, some people would argue, yeah, it's all because of the tariffs, but you said it yourself. I mean, I think the interesting thing is for years we had like, you know, inflation run higher than its target. It's been for the last couple of years, maybe five years.
It's ran at exactly, you know, pick your metric, right? PCE is run at 4%. And everyone, before I just talked about core inflation, but the Fed actually targets headline inflation, to be clear, right? I mean, they focus on core to see where the trend is. Over the last 5 years, 2021 to 2026, February, March, PCE is running an average of 4%, CPI is running an average of 4.5%. Then you think, oh, it's all 2022. After that's been okay. No. Forget, set aside 2022, 2023, 24, 25 into 2026.
Yeah.
PCE is running an average of 3%. That's 100 basis points above target.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. And what are the underlying reasons for this? Is it all still like the hangover from the COVID sort of supply chain shortages that we had, or disruption, you know, or like what are the underlying driving forces of this, like inflation just being stubbornly higher than target inflation for these many years? You know, can we point to underlying factors?
I think we're just in the inflationary regime where you get one shock after another.
Okay.
Right? COVID, yeah. You mentioned it, supply chain bottlenecks. Then we had Russia and Ukraine, the war there sent energy and food prices, most importantly, up as well. And then we got the tariff thing, right? And we got the tariff issue. And then we got the immigration stall. So labor supply is completely curtailed as well. And that's, I think, underrated as a cause, because it's hard to quantify, like, how is that translated to higher prices for services, things like that, right? And then now we have the energy crisis from another shock from the Middle East, energy crisis. And who knows what that's going to do for, you know, downstream petroleum goods, plastics, which are used for packaging. And, you know, you need feedstock for all sorts of things. I mean, but I think it also gets to, you look at, we're talking mostly about goods. People think, oh, yeah, goods prices are going up because of bottlenecks, of course. But even services, one thing I like to look at is inflation for restaurants. Mm-hmm. And this is CPI for full service meals and snacks. I think it's useful because it combines several inflation drivers. One is obviously food prices and even energy prices, because you need to transport food, right? That's why diesel comes in, right? And then you get rents in there, rents of restaurant premises, and you get worker wages, right? Inflation for seated dining restaurants was up at an annualized pace of 3.6% in March. Year over year, it's running about 4.3%. Over the last few years, it's been running somewhere between 4 to 5%. Before the pandemic, all the way looking at late 90s to 2020, it was closer to about 3%. We're running well above that. That tells me that maybe the labor market is, you know, harder than we think it is. I'm not saying the labor market is in great shape. Certainly not. I mean, hiring slowed. But there's a supply issue. It goes back to, you know, like the supply chain impact on goods and AI bottlenecks and things like that. I think there's a labor supply thing happening as well, which is why restaurant prices continue to remain, you know, well above, you know, trend in terms of inflation. So just to give you a services picture there.
Too. Yes, exactly. I mean, some people are also, if we go back to maybe an underlying factor, some people are also pointing to the deficits, you know, the fiscal deficits that we've been having and that are sort of still running kind of hot. And if you want to believe Trump, he was just recently, I think he mentioned that he will ask Congress to enact a massive increase in defense spending and stuff like this. And so I'd be wondering, how do you factor this in? Does this play into your analysis as well? How do you think about these deficits? Is that a reason as well, as so many people say?
Yeah, I think in a sense, deficits essentially new money creation into the economy. Right? That's what it is. Now, last year, deficits actually slightly fell. So the way we think about, because everyone says, okay, the stock market's not the economy, which is true. But how to connect that, and the way we connect it is through profits.
Yeah.
Right? So we take a very, I think the last guest you had, who was sort of MNT, I forget the gentleman's name. He talked about this. So that's kind of similar. It was interesting because we have a similar sort of framework, how I think about connecting the economy to the stock market via profits. Where do profits come from? We take a sectoral balance sheet approach, right? There are three big sectors in the economy. Households, the private sector in terms of businesses, and the government. There is a foreign sector as well, right? So actually four if you count the foreign sector too. So what contributes to profits? Investments, businesses investing, right? One business investing or buying a chip or building a data center contributes to another business's revenue and profits, right? That's why I think we are positive the AI build out. that's huge for, you know. Now, some of the winners and losers may change because who's keeping, you know, who's on the other side of that revenue and profits, right? Who's on the other side of spending? But on aggregate, that's positive for profits, investment spending. Household dis-saving, right? As households save less. And that's what we saw last year. The savings rate came down, right? That's positive for profits. Government deficits, right? Government deficits is also positive for profits. And now I'm not saying there's no other, you know, we could talk about bonds and, you know, yields and inflation on the other side of it, getting back to your question. But that gets to the fact that, you know, like money is being created. Where is it flowing? It's flowing into the pockets of businesses in the form of revenues and profits. And then the current account surplus, now the U.S. has a deficit. So usually it's a drag. The deficit keeps increasing. So it's a drag on profits. But last year, the deficit didn't increase as much, not because we didn't import as many goods. We actually imported more goods in 2025 than we did in 2024. The trade deficit went up. But the current account deficit shrunk and contributed to profits. That's because income that Americans received on assets we invest in assets abroad, the income we received was more than the income we paid out to foreigners, right? Income receipts are higher. So that's why the current account deficit shrank. And that was a positive for profits. So it was actually strange. Despite the trade deficit increasing, I mean, there's services too, but the trade deficit actually went up. That should be a drag. But then the current account deficit was down because of higher income receipts into the U.S. So this is how the sectoral balance sheet approach is how I think about connecting what's happening in the economy. And when you think about the economy, what matters more is nominal GDP growth. Most people focus, you know, with good reason, real GDP growth, because that's actually real, right? Mm-hmm. After you have to inflation adjust, right?
Yeah.
But what matters for profits and revenue is nominal.
Yes, exactly.
But that's also why stocks are a real asset over time. I'm not saying stocks are a perfect hedge for inflation or something, but they do protect against inflation over the long term, right? Profits, you know, I to put it very simply, and this is very simplistic, one company's margin expansion is yours and my inflation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I don't mean to say it's a bad thing. You know, there are, for example, South Korean chip makers are in the right place at the right time. Now everybody needs memory chips, but their margins are going up. Memory chip prices are going up, right? Same thing with energy companies. They didn't cause the crisis and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, but they were in the right place at the right time, and now their margins are increasing, right? But that's also inflation.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, it's this balance sheet approach, you know, that there's always a pro and a con, and there's like a passive and an active side of things. And so,
yep.
Yeah, it's exactly it. Like, a lot of people miss this when it comes to the creation of money, when it comes to profits and stuff. And so, yeah, you always have to look at both sides of the medal. I mean, you know, you shared this very interesting chart that I also picked up on, you know, where you were showing that the chart was showing corporate profits as a share of gross domestic product, GDP, have consistently been growing, you know, and I found this so interesting. And I guess from what we just discussed, I mean, it's been going on the chart goes back to, I think, the 1960s, you know, as far as I can recall. And so if you look at the last couple of decades or even years, I mean, it's been higher than before. And it's probably due to the facts that you just all laid out well, you know, because of all these factors. So what are the reasons for this? Are we just more productive nowadays as well? Or like, why are profits up?
I mean, I think that was someone else's chart, but I tell you, one thing is, it should technically be corporate profits over gross corporate value add.
Yeah.
Because that's a value add corporate, because GDP is much more than just corporations, right?
Yes, exactly.
Households. It's not just corporations, there's governments and all of that too. So it technically should be corporate value add, but you'll see the same general trend, right?
Yeah.
It's just going up and to the right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you connect that immediately to the stock market. Why is the stock market gone up? It's gone up and to the right because corporate profits are going up and to the right. I mean, you normalize with, you know, corporate value add, which is basically sales in a way. But it tells you its margins are going up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So now you think about going back to national accounting. And it's very hard to, you have to be careful drawing causal impact from these things. But you think about, you know, nominal wage growth is productivity plus inflation.
Yeah.
Plus change in labor share, right? As labor,
yes.
So you think, and then you think, you know, nominal minus inflation, you take inflation to the right side if you think of an equation.
Wow.
Real wage growth is productivity plus change in labor share, right? So if we're getting more productive, real wages should go up, yeah. You know, unless labor share comes down, yeah. Right? So all of those productivity, even during the 90s, real wage growth was very strong. Even in 23, 2024, real wage growth was fairly strong because productivity was pretty strong. But all of those productivity gains, companies didn't pass on to workers in the form of real wage growth. They expanded margins as well. Now, that's the other side, a change in labor share. If that's going down, that means margins are going up. Connecting that back to what Jesus said, corporate profits over, let's say, corporate value add or GDP, some fraction of GDP, that's been going up. That's margins going up. That means labor share is going down. Right? So that's essentially from a national accounting. So the big picture is all of the productivity growth that we've seen, whether it's very good, mediocre in the 2000s and 2010s, it's not all gone to households. Corporations took that as margin expansion.
Yeah. Yeah. Margin, it's also a good keyword. I mean, you know, I talked to Jordy Fisser, one of these macro guys. You might have heard of his name as well. He's all over the AI, you know, telling us constantly that like AI will only help margins to go up with companies because they can take profit of this or benefit from this. And so if we factor in, if we look into the future,
it goes back to the idea of if labor share goes down because of AI, it means margins are going up. It's just the opposite, right?
Exactly. I was just going to be like, you will have AI as a force, you know, bringing labor share down, but then maybe demographics is maybe also a force that's pulling this down, I would argue. And so, or like, how do you connect these two things, you know, or like just thinking about the future? Yeah.
Yeah. Thinking ahead, like we always get the question, will AI take away all the jobs?
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, thinking back to that, okay, real wage growth, productivity minus margin expansion. Incident. Now let's say it's minus, you know, margin expansion, right? And I'm skeptical that AI will take away all the jobs. To an extent, yes, right? Sure. But I think it'll be more of a churn, right? Like there'll be different sort of winners versus losers. And it sucks for people on the wrong side of it, just like it sucked for people on the wrong side of globalization, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so, but that's a policy thing. Set that aside, right? So I'm skeptical because last year was a good example of we saw pretty strong productivity growth. And now we have to be careful about, you know, using numbers like productivity growth over short periods of time. I mean, because it's so noisy. But still, productivity growth is fairly strong in 2025. But we didn't see much real wage growth. It all went to margin expansion, right? That can go only for so long, because at the end of the day, you need somebody to be spending. You can't just, it cannot just be businesses just, you know, rotating money across them, right? No, maybe the government spends and it's a government that's, you know, because they say, oh, we want to keep the unemployment rate low, you know, like, let's just give the people money, like checks, right? You don't work, but we're giving you checks. The deficit goes up and that feeds into corporate profits. I could see that. But that's so extreme. Like, you know, the politics has to favor that too. So, and so I, all this to say, I'm skeptical that we'll be in an environment where we see zero wage growth, real wage growth, and margins just continue expanding for, you can see it over short periods of time, maybe a year, year and a half, but over 3, 4, 5 years, I think at some point you'd be like, oh, households are not spending enough. And so because of that, corporate companies start saying, you know what? We don't have end demand. We're going to invest less. Right? And then that goes the other way.
I see. And how do you think about demographics in that regard? I mean, you know, demographics and people are getting older. Obviously, older people, they spend a lot. So you will have the spending. Yeah. But then like work-wise, you know, the labor participation rate might be going down because like older people are not going to work anymore. Like, how do you factor this effect in, you know, or how do you think about this in conjunction with what we just said, you know?
I mean, in a way, it's sort of like a supply thing, right? Like one thing that's been interesting is the overall participation rate has come down because of demographics. But we know, that's because of demographics. But then you look at going back to the labor market and why we thought maybe it's stronger than what headline payrolls have suggested over the last 6 months, is because you look at the prime age employment population ratio. How many people in their prime age working is 25 to 54 as a percent of the population are working, right? It's a little cleaner than the unemployment rate because the unemployment rate is like who's defined as unemployed, right?
Yeah.
Like you have to be looking for a job and you have to sort of satisfy certain requirements and things like that. Employment population ratio is like how many people are working? Overpopulation. And prime age workers, that's sitting at 80.7%. That is higher than at any point across the 2000s expansion, any point across the 2010s expansion.
Yeah.
Right?
Interesting.
That's pretty strong. So that's, and then now for younger workers, I think this is interesting. If you think, okay, AI is taking away jobs, you think, okay, that's going to really hurt young people, especially people coming out of college. But what's interesting over the last few months is we've actually seen the unemployment rate for 20 to 24 year olds go down. It was about, it is like 10% or something like that. It's gone down to about 8%. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I can send you a chart. That's gone down over, it's actually lower now than it was 12, 14, 15 months ago. Now, if AI was really taking away all the jobs, it's like, wait a minute, that unemployment rate shouldn't be going down. Best case, you know, it should be flat, if not going up, right? So,
yeah.
Why do you think this is the case? Do you have any explanation for this? Or
I think right now, the AI is taking away jobs is probably overrated a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not happening on the edges, but I think AI is being used more as a productivity enhancement tool rather than saying, you know, I'm going to replace this worker with AI.
Yeah.
And at some point we may see that, but I think, you know, generally, like, I think that's where we are at.
We're just not there yet. Yeah. Very interesting. I want to come back to the here and now, you know, and maybe tie this all back to you know, the Fed and central banks, because as I said at the onset, I feel like this is really the driving factor now, and everyone is kind of trying to figure out, okay, what are the central banks are going to do? And I guess if you look to Europe, I think hikes are already priced in.
Yeah, I think about two rate hikes or something.
Yes, exactly. In the US, we're maybe flattish and it's just going to be a pause. How do you think about the work or the activity of central banks going forward? Like, did the oil shock just make it harder for them and their work?
Well, I'll put it this way. Given what we knew about the inflation picture, even before the crisis.
Yeah.
I'd be like, I thought the rate cuts last year were a mistake. Now, if your target is 2%, if your target's 3%, that's okay.
Yeah.
Right? But if you're saying a target is 2%.
Which it still officially is.
Yeah, we know it is. Like, and literally, I think it was the Chicago Federal Reserve board member, the president, Austin Goolsbee, I saw him on a video clip of him the other day, saying, we are never changing that. It's 2%. We need to get inflation back to 2%. You've run above 3%. No, above 2%. You've run at 3% PCE over the last 3 years, even after 2022.
Yeah.
The next 2 years, and it's not going back to 2% anytime soon. Like, of course, now this energy shock is going to flow through. Then we have the AI-related bottlenecks, and, you know, services still look fairly hot. Inflation is not going down to 2%. And it's like, okay, so what do you do about that? You do one of two things with your central bank. You say, you know what, the target is 3%. They're not going to do that. Or they say, you know, we are going to raise rates by a lot to get inflation back to 2%. They're not going to do it. Not in the US. That's not happening with this Fed. And then, which means, and I can share a chart showing the, you know, where we have PCE inflation relative to 3 month yields. 3 month yields sort of capture the policy rate anyway. And comparing that to the 1970s, right? And I'm not a huge fan of comparing things to the 1970s. We're in a very different place. And I compare PCE because CPI. One problem is you've seen those dual spike inflation charts, right?
Yeah,
CPI, the methodology has changed. I mean, for one thing, in the 70s and early 80s, CPI had even mortgage rates in it. So when Paul Volcker raised interest rates, it actually sent inflation CPI higher because mortgage rates went down, right? So it was almost like... But I think PCE is more comparable across time, and I'll share that chart with you. And I put the three-month yield on top of it because what you see is up until the mid to 77, 78, Yeah, the Fed was probably not as tight as they wanted to be. I mean, you know, in 1974, 75, as inflation came down, the Fed took their foot off the brakes, proverbial economic brake, which is interest rates. And then inflation didn't come back to where it was before, you know, in the early 1970s. It stayed elevated, or 4, 5, 6%. Mm. And then we got another shock. And then, boom, everything went up again. Then Paul Volcker had to take rates to 10, 15, 20% to get it down. Then we got a recession. So my thing is, I mean, I'm not saying the Fed needs to take, you know, inflation or interest rates to 10% or anything like that. But, you know, maybe rates have to be higher than 3.5%. Maybe it needs to be 4.5% for some time. To, or even 5% or maybe 6% to get it down. But they're not doing that, which means if they're holding steady right now while inflation's going up, what's happening? Policy is basically getting looser.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, like, what happens to real rates from here on out? I mean, I see the possibility for them to go down, you know, which would be positive equities.
Positive equities, positive gold. Right. Yeah. Like if the implied policy rate is getting looser, right, that's a positive, especially over the short term for equities. It's very positive for gold. I mean, what hurts gold, right? Mm. Higher real rates. And we saw that during this crisis. The crisis at February 27th, 28th is when the war started.
Yeah.
And then real rates saw a big surge. What was the asset class that got hit the most over the next 4 weeks? Broad asset class. I mean, not the sub industries and things like that. Gold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gold got really hit because real rates went up a lot, right? But now real rates are taking it easy. Gold's rallying. Again, it goes back to the idea that inflation's picking up. The Fed hasn't had an inflation problem before the pandemic, but they're keeping rates steady. In fact, some of the new governor incoming chair, Kevin Warsh, is probably thinking about cutting rates.
Yeah,
I mean, which
is
fine. Like, it is what it is. I mean, we have to manage money based on what policymakers do. Nobody's listening to me. Like, it doesn't matter what I think, you know, I would do in their position, right? That's a whole different thing. There are other pressures and all sorts of things on central banks. I get it. But I think policy is loose. That's a tailwind for equities, in addition to deficits, for the reasons I mentioned. Deficits flow into profits. I think that's another tailwind for equities, right? And I think the AI bottleneck leads to inflation, but inflation's other side is margin expansion. So what equities are doing today, the S&P 500, I'm looking at my other screen here, it's 7,133, new high. It's up 1.3%. This is April 17th, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I want to get at. You know, a lot of people are now looking at the, or at least for the past few days, they've been looking at the screens and like, okay, this doesn't make sense. You know, we're sort of in this war situation, oil, you know, might be getting out of control and have all these second and third order effects, and still equity markets are at the new all-time high. You know, Bitcoin is holding steady. How does the Russell 3000 is that reaching a new all-time high?
Or small caps,
yes
too, right?
And so for a lot of people that was sort of contradictory, but you're now just saying it actually makes sense if you think through the mechanics of it all. Real rates, you know, just like I checked it this morning, slightly 60 basis points from turning negative in the US, you know. In Japan, I think they're already negative. In Europe, just only so turned positive. It all adds up in that sense. But then, do you see the possibility for a melt up in markets, despite, you know, the maybe oil order, or like the second order effects from oil still maybe only to hit the markets, you know? So,
I think so. We came into the year overweight equities, and we still stayed overweight equities throughout this. Sometimes it's like, oh my God, like, should we move? But this gets back to your first question.
Yeah.
When all this noise is coming at you, what do you do? And it's valid noise. I wouldn't even say, like, the Strait of Hormuz being closed was not noise. That is signal in a way.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's closed. There are no ships passing through. There's no oil flow going through.
Mm.
Right. So that's a reality we have to deal with. But then you think, okay, what's on the other side of that? Right. Mm. Of course, you know, without getting into trying to predict when the crisis will end, when it won't end, it's like, wait a minute. Oh, obviously, energy companies benefit.
Yeah.
And I think one thing we've seen over the year to date, and even over the last month with this recovery, companies making stuff have done well. Energy, obviously, right? And they're in the right place at the time. Mm. But look at industrials. Industrials have done well.
Yes. Right?
Technology companies, tech is interesting because, you know, you think about tech as three buckets. You think the semiconductors, obviously, they're making stuff that we all need. Now everybody needs that for the AI build out. Telecom's done well too. We've been, you know, like speaking for ourselves, now I'm talking about our portfolio, we've been overweight these two areas of the market. I mean, semis, because we've been overweight the momentum factor, inside momentum, you know, semis are a big part of that. And then we've been explicitly overweight telecom as well. But then there's a third bucket of technology, which has, pardon my language, sucked. That's software.
Software, yeah.
Yeah. But tech is back to, like, the NASDAQ's back to all-time highs. And I think it's driven by the part of technology that's making stuff.
Yeah.
Right? If that makes sense. So then materials are doing well too, right? Mm. And then you think about, like, even Europe and emerging markets to an extent, like, a, you know, say what you want about, well, you're in Europe, so you won't complain about me saying this, but, you know, in America, there's been like, oh, Europe sucks, and, you know, they don't know what they're doing. And, but, you know, if you look at most European baskets, it's companies making stuff. They've done well. They outperformed, you know, Europe's outperformed the U.S. year to date. It outperformed the U.S. last year. In 2023, we didn't predict a recession. Unlike a lot of other people, we were very overweight equities. We were overweight equities into 2024 and even 2025, but the composition changed. At that time, 2023, 2024, we were pedal to the metal U.S. mostly. Heavily underweight Europe and emerging. Last year, after the news from Germany and then the AI stuff, everything happening, like, it's not like we like international more. We went to a neutral weight, in neutral U.S. versus international.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where we, how we've been positioned for about 14 months or so now. Right? Yeah, and that's helped absolute return. So, yeah, I think, and going back to my point about, you know, a lot of European and even emerging market companies make stuff. I think that's helped.
That certainly helped. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe just commenting on one thing that you said, the software thing. It is interesting, you know, and I was just looking at it yesterday, IGV up, I think it even outperformed the rest of the market, or at least like other components, you know, and that was quite interesting because we just saw Anthropic, you know, launch their latest model.
Yes.
And then you're like,
my
okay,
thoughts, yeah.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Opus 4.7 or something. And everything that's been going on in the last couple of months, like software just kept on bleeding, you know. But now it feels like there's been a turnaround. And that's just a theory of mine, but I could be wrong, obviously. But maybe if Anthropic and OpenAI, they're going to IPO sometime this year, I wouldn't be surprised to see software kind of catch a bit during these IPOs, which would be kind of counterintuitive, but we'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other side of it is now we're going into earnings season.
Yeah.
All these software companies are going to come in and say, oh, earnings are fine.
High margins they have still. Yeah.
Yeah. So because all of us are still using your, you know, it's not a recommendation, anything like that. Your Salesforce, CRM, we're still using the software. So, you know, now maybe, you know, contract negotiations, the next time that comes up with these software companies, they'll have a problem. Yeah. But they've been beaten down so much.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And even that gets to, like, the rally started on March 30th for the aggregate indices, equity market indices, S&P down, NASDAQ, for example, and even foreign indices. Software continued to go down up until, like, I think 2 days ago. And now the last 2-3 days, now, as I said, we're speaking of April 17th. From April 13th, so 14th, 15th, the last few days, that's what software has like rallied. But it was so beaten down. And I am going to be watching earnings closely, like what the, you know, the reaction to the companies. Like, I know what the companies are going to say. They're like, you're making money hand over fist. But the question is, how do markets react to that?
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. Well, I wanted to turn, before we finish off here, maybe to gold once more, because you mentioned it, you know, and with real rates potentially going down, I mean, it's positive gold. Gold had its huge run last year, obviously. And now the question is, okay, where does gold go from here? And one thing that I was wondering, like, it seems to be a somewhat still bullish outlook, but then geopolitical risk maybe has somewhat waned, you know, or at least the market has kind of gotten used to it and is looking through it. And then another thing I think, which is quite established, is that it's been central banks that have been buying gold, you know. And there I wonder, with the oil shock, you know, if you look to countries, I don't know if they are relevant, but if you look to countries like the Philippines or Sri Lanka and these countries, I think they have problems now on their hand with oil, you know, and maybe governments have to kind of ration where the money is going because they have to kind of help people with the oil prices and stuff. And that is money that at the margin couldn't be going into gold. I don't know. Do you see these connections, or is it sort of overblown, or where do you see gold going with central banks maybe?
I'll start with the last point, because I think there's some valid, because it's like, oh, they have to protect their currencies and things like that.
Yeah.
And part of their reserves may be gold, so let's sell gold.
Yeah.
Like, no, but these are smaller countries. But I think last month, I thought I saw a headline, I couldn't be sure, but, you know, I think the Turkish central bank sold some gold as well, right? So that was there as part of this. So getting to your point about, you know, this operation, but I think that's relatively small compared to the larger central banks who may be buying gold, and even things like demand in India. But then there's, I'm originally from India. My name actually means gold. That is not why we like gold. We've actually liked gold. So now going back to this, your original question, like the outlook for gold, we've been positive on gold for 3 years now, right? We actually put gold in our portfolios during, I don't know if you remember, the Silicon Valley Bank crisis.
Yeah.
Back in 2023, March. Right. We had that. And at that time, we were like, okay, we didn't think there'd be a recession. But we were like, you know, we manage portfolios. So we have to protect the portfolio somehow. And we didn't really like long bonds at that time. We're like, mm-hmm. okay, what's a good diversifier? We use gold. Mm-hmm. Now, I certainly didn't predict that gold would increase 70% last year, and nor even, you know, it's up like, what, 12, 13% this year. And I didn't predict that. I'll take it. Right? Like,
yeah.
But we use it as a diversifier, and, you know, it's worked out. So even coming into this year, yes, it went on this big run. But I think our general thesis falls into, you said it, real rates. Mm-hmm. If real rates, I'll put it this way, what could crush gold? Real rates going up. If the central bank comes out tomorrow and say, you know what, we are serious about taking inflation down to 2%.
Yeah.
We are going to take rates up to 6%, for example, or even 5%. Real rates are going to surge. Gold is going to get trashed, right? Yeah. That's, I think, the danger
key
for
risk,
gold.
Yeah.
But for now, I don't think that's on the cards. In fact, I think we're going to get a Fed chair that is actually talking about dropping rates.
Yeah.
I think that's positive for gold. Now, at some point, I don't know if it's a year from now. I don't know if it's 3 years from now or even 5 years from now. Consumers are going to be sick of inflation. There could be some political pressure to take care of this.
Mm.
And this goes back to everybody feels inflation. Only a few people feel unemployment.
Yeah. Yeah.
At some point, there may be pressure. You may get someone. And we wrote about this in our outlook. How could the cycle end? Right. One is fairly obvious. If you have one part of the economy really boosting GDP growth, AI, basically the AI build out, if that stops, that's a hit because you're going the opposite direction. Right. Mm. So the more the economy relies on one thing, that gets more risky. The other side, and this gets to how, you know, what could end the rally, for example, is a very hawkish Fed. Mm. The analogy I made was to the late 60s, right? Inflation went up, they raised rates, but then they were like, okay, let's cut rates because inflation's going down. And then by 68, 69, they were like, uh-oh, inflation's a problem. And that was the time when we had a lot of deficits too. We had the Vietnam War, Medicare, mm-hmm. Medicaid, all of it. Like, it was guns and butter, basically.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Yeah.
And the Fed had to raise rates.
Mm.
Then we went to a recession, right? And interestingly, there was a tech story there as well, like the Nifty 50 and, you know, all of that, right, during that period as well. So that's a lot of analogies compare this current period because of AI and technology to the 90s. And I'm like, maybe the more apt comparison is to the late 60s, And of course, the longer the Fed takes to control inflation or get inflation back to the target, assuming they don't say the target is 3%, then I don't think they're going to do that. But that's a slippery slope, right? Today it's 3%. Why not 3.5% then, right? Why not 4% then, right? And so at some point, Fed chair may come in saying, you know, we need to get this back under control. You're going to raise rates. Yes, that may mean a recession, but I think that's a risk.
Yeah, that's definitely a risk. Well, maybe last question. Given let's assume, or for the sake of the argument, we'll be in this higher inflation regime for quite some time, and central banks won't be coming in anytime soon. Like, what are the implications for traditional portfolios? Maybe we already talked about this, but maybe we can sum it up again. Everyone's talking about the 60-40 portfolio is dead. So, yeah, but how do you position in such a regime?
I think it's positive. Speaking for ourselves, and this gets to how we are positioned as well, positive for equities, which means we underweight diversifiers, we underweight bonds, but we are also underweight duration to an extent. We're not throwing out duration. We want some duration. What if we're wrong and we get a recession? Bonds will do well in that period. Yeah. We know that. So you want some of that. You don't want to throw that out. But we want to diversify our diversifiers. We are in a higher inflationary regime. It's not just that inflation we think will average, let's say, 3%. 3% or 2% doesn't seem like a big deal. Over time, it is a big deal, I would argue, because that really erodes purchasing power, right? 3% compounded over 5 years is much worse than 2% compounded over 5 years.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
But I think the other side is, you know, like, we'll see inflation volatility as well, right? And that gets back to why, you know, we are underweight long bonds. We underweight long bonds. We underweight even corporate bonds because corporate bond spreads are really tight.
Yeah.
Right? Corporate bonds, especially high yield, is sort of like you're taking kind of an equity market bet. Why not just take the equity market bet? Just be overweight equity.
Anyways.
So that's where we are. Yeah. So we're diversifying and diversifiers. We have cash and bonds, some long bonds, but we also have gold for the reasons we talked about. We also have managed futures.
Yeah.
Okay, now, on a day like today, managed futures is not the prettiest place to be. When oil drops 10%. But that's why if everything in your portfolio is working and going up, that means you're probably not diversified enough.
Yeah.
Right? But over the last month, that helped. When oil went from $67 a barrel to $110, $115. Yeah. And so it goes both ways, right? But generally, I think, the other side of inflation is margin expansion. I think that's why, going back to the point about it, why we are overweight equities.
Maybe last question, just because out of personal interest, what's your guys' view on Bitcoin? Like, you have a view at all? Or,
I mean, because we are positive, we view Bitcoin as a risk-on asset. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to maybe the real rate scenario, if there's more liquidity in the system, you know, people have more money to spend, people buy it, right? And maybe there's some demand as the world tries to, I don't want to overplay this too much, but you know, as the world tries to step away from the dollar a little bit, it's like, you know, what do you use? I mean, maybe crypto works as a means to transfer money across the world instead of using the dollar-based system. But the irony there being that even stable coins are based on treasuries, right?
So there's probably going to be the dollar,
ultimately, it's the same thing. But still, right? On the surface, it seems different. But I think the bigger thing is, it's a risk on asset. That's the way we think about it. When there's more liquidity in the system, when we are sort of like real rates are not surging, it's generally a positive for assets like this. We have some Bitcoin in the portfolio as well, but we are not thinking of that quite as a diversifier. That's like, you know, it's part of the risk assets that we have.
Yeah. It's probably the way, right thing to think about it. At least as of now. I mean, a lot of Bitcoiners would argue, oh, they want it to be risk off, you know, but it's not yet. It's not yet.
But that hasn't quite played out.
Yeah.
Which is fine. It is what it is. I mean, you know, like, that's our challenge, right? I mean, we have Bitcoin in the portfolio, but how do you diversify it? Maybe gold is a diversifier to Bitcoin. Maybe bonds are the diversifier to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And manage features and things like that. So I think this is a time when you want a lot of things in your portfolio. You don't want to be too concentrated.
Yes, great. Sonu, I think that's been great. Thanks a lot for these great set of explanation that you provided here. So where can people find you guys? Where can people reach out to you if they want to connect? And thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, so carsongroup.com/research is our page. I mean, we write a lot. The whole team writes a lot. I mean, we have something up there every day that gets to how we are thinking about the world around us. And then Facts versus Feelings, the podcast, Ryan and me are talking about this week in, week out. So you'll find that on Apple and Spotify, YouTube as well, if you want to see some charts too. And normally I would say you can find me on X, you know, Sonu S. Verghese. But right now my account is in Twitter jail because, or X jail, because of like a hack. I can sort of get it. I can't get into it, but I have control over my password, but it's requiring me to put in some two-factor authentication, which I don't have. And so hopefully I'll be out of Twitter jail in a, you know, in a few days,
hopefully. Crazy.
That would normally be the best place to reach me. But hey, you know, our YouTube channel is there if you want to put a comment there too.
That's amazing.
Maybe a
way to go. Great. So let's hope you'll be freed, or your account will be freed quite soon. And no, that was amazing. Thanks a lot for doing this. Enjoy the rest of your day and then happy weekend. And hopefully we can do this in the future again.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Thank you. Bye.